we're not being smart about the things that are going on in the city. And I think that the cities that are going to be the leaders going forward are going to be the ones that demonstrate that they're thinking 25 years ahead.
Howard, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So we're going to talk about culture to start. And can you speak to how you've successfully built culture within an organization and what are some of the challenges that leaders are facing now?
Sure. I think the biggest thing that I would say is that you lead by example. I mean, as sort of trite as that sounds, our cultures have always been doing everything with a vengeance. It's always been a competitive culture. It's always been a culture that focused on paying attention to the details. And because it's hard for a startup to deal with institutional customers and sort of traditional customers, if you don't demonstrate that kind of attention and focus, you know, we live in this fake it until you make it world, unfortunately. And so a lot of organizations are a little wary of dealing with startups. And since my focus for the last 30 or 40 years has been primarily new businesses, it's really important to get off on the right foot. So, and the right foot is always the same. I mean, it's basically no shortcuts. It's basically paying attention to details. It's honoring your commitments. And what I feel like is so scary in the work from home world and the remote world that we're now in is I'd say 75 or 80% of all of that sort of culture comes from osmosis. It doesn't come from meetings. It doesn't come from coaches. It comes from mentoring, but it's mentoring in as much of an informal way as it is a formal way. And so when you don't have proximity and you don't have a chance to watch and observe how other people relate and act in these kinds of circumstances, it's very hard to build a culture. I wrote a piece recently for my Inc. column called You Can't Build a Culture in the Cloud. And I think that's right. I think companies are going to have to figure out how to bring their people back together. Maybe it's on a more limited basis. But when you do, I also think it's an interesting issue. I think that you better have a reason. You better have an educational event or you better have a meeting of substance. Because if you just bring your people in because you told them they have to be in 3 days a week, that's the worst kind of message. That's the whatever message. And that's from the old play, How to Succeed in Business, the guys who would hang their sport coat on the back of their chair and then leave for the day. So I think that you have to have an authentic culture. I think you have to lead by example. And I think that you can demonstrate to kids that a work ethic is not something to be uncool about or to be ashamed of. It's important to demonstrate that. People look for the people they can count on and depend on. And so I think that's the kind of people you want to bring into your company. I just did a recent talk for a big securities firm. And a lot of these consulting firms, securities firms, and law firms are all engaged in this process of let's hire the best five people in the world. And what they're discovering is that some of those people don't have any interest in their culture or working for them, for their kind of organization. And my answer was, then forget those people and find the people that are leaning in your direction, because there's plenty of them out there. And it's much more successful if you're trying to encourage somebody. I call this ride the horse in the direction he's headed. You're not going to convert these kids. There are some people that came out of systems and schools and parental situations, and they've just been told that they walk on water, and you're not going to fix that. And so you might as well find somebody who thinks that they believe in the principles and the philosophies of your business.
And in the environment, in the virtual environment, where a number of companies are setting people up virtually, maybe they come in the office, can you actually integrate in mentorship effectively early on? Because what we're hearing is it's just not effective initially. And mentorship is probably one of the biggest issues.
Well, I think that you have to have, first of all, I think you have to have meetings after meetings. So I think that if you have a larger meeting, a lot of the communications that are critical actually don't happen in the big meeting. And so I think you have to set up ways that people can get together in smaller groups to exchange their reactions, talk about things they were uncomfortable raising in the big meeting. A lot of stuff that goes on, again, when it's easy to do it because you're walking back from a meeting with three other people. On Zoom, the minute that leave button is hit, that's it. And then you go back to whatever it is you were doing at home, if you were paying attention during the meeting to begin with. So it's possible. I think it's just something that you have to do. And as we were discussing before, I think the one thing we're missing in a lot of Zoom meetings is there's really nobody who runs the meeting. And I honestly think you need somebody that's almost like a moderator to sort of preserve order, to make sure that the topics that are critical get taken care of and that people are engaged in the process. So we're going to see Zoom grow, or we're going to see, let's say, the idea of using teleconferencing grow over time as we develop the new etiquette about it. But for sure, right now, everything that you could imagine being wrong with Zoom is wrong, including that, you know, I call this the Trump doctrine, that just because you shout something doesn't make it true. You know, in Zoom meetings, it's the loudest voice. It's the person who's most verbal. It's the person who's, you know, so most opinionated. And that's rarely productive in a meeting. I mean, what you want to do is get everybody to be thoughtful and to contribute. And the Zoom situation basically isn't there yet.
Yeah. I did a podcast just before this one where we talked about Generation Z, and they're going to represent 27% of the workforce in 2025. One of the elements that came out of that conversation was that they're the first generation that truly has been accustomed to technology. And it's a little bit of a push-pull because they're used to communicating via Slack and other, you know, text and things, but they do want that in-person ability. So yeah. It's kind of...
Well, we're immigrants and they're digital natives for sure. Yeah. That, yep. And they are adept, remarkably adept at using the digital communication tools, much more so in some respects than we are. However, I'll tell you, I just wrote a piece this week about cybersecurity. 70% or so of the issues in terms of employee problems with security emerge from Gen Z kids. They think that they understand all the technology. They think that they're smarter than everyone else. And they're the easiest and the most susceptible to some of these scams and problems that we're seeing in all companies with digital security. This is a whole nother issue, by the way. As we all come back to the network, as we all come back to the home servers, we're going to bring back whatever it is that our kids loaded onto our machines when they used our laptops to play whatever crazy games they played over the last couple of years during COVID. And so there's serious virus issues, there's serious security issues. But on the other hand, as you said, I mean, they have an appetite for communication that's significant. And I would say that they're a little bit too inclined to bring their whole selves to work. I'd like to see the world take a couple of steps back because
amen.
Between TMI and please don't share me, you know, that. And look, this is not only their fault. I mean, we've had helicopter parents. We've had academics who tell them that they're the most fabulous thing since sliced bread. And the truth is when you get them, I mean, a lot of companies are engaged right now in figuring out how much remedial education do we have to do with incoming employees to teach them about spelling, to teach them how to construct a letter, to teach them some things that are very basic for us because we grew up in a different training system. But they really haven't. They really, you know, a letter is a perfectly good example. I mean, when you write a communication, a letter, you've actually got a reason and you've got some structure to it. That's not an email. It's not the same situation. And I honestly think that the digital Slack Teams world sort of encourages us to just dump a stream of consciousness into these communications, not to think about it, not to try and figure out, and never to edit. And so, you know, that has cheapened and sort of made much less useful a great deal of our communications.
Right. What do you see as some of the advantages and disadvantages of working from home for, let's say, with a startup company?
Well, first of all, I think that, I mean, if there was a fair survey, I think that we would discover that people work more hours over COVID at home than they did during the pre-COVID period of time. And I attribute that to three things. One, certainly we've recaptured an average of an hour to 2 hours of commuting time, which was completely unproductive time. Second of all, I think that the truth is that most white-collar workers, after you put your kids to bed or whatever it is that you, you know, end your family commitment day, I mean, you're sitting there and, you know, these offices and these companies that years ago said, oh, please turn off your email at 6 o'clock, must live on a different planet than we do. Because I think that a lot of the workforce went back to work. And I also think that you're able to balance work life at home in a much more effective way. I mean, I just think that the goal is to figure out how to deal with random chores and interruptions. I think that that's, flow is very important. If you do certain kinds of work, I think it's very important to figure out how to have an uninterrupted period of time. But having said that, the ability to make up for lost time with your family, the ability to handle other kinds of activities, I think that we're never going back, because I think that it's turned out to be a way of substantially improving the balance in our lives.
Yeah. So we're in a beautiful all steel innovation center, and it's got, you know, all the new furniture that's designed. It's really kind of more going to resimercial, right? Where people are coming into the office and having those meetings at a couch in a corner somewhere, as opposed to an office. And then maybe have a touchdown phone room or something like that. In your opinion, and maybe every company is a little different, and that's what I see, but what's the physical space? What's the optimal physical space for an organization now?
Well, I think it's going to be smaller. I think on average, it'll be smaller in terms of the footprint. I think that we've outlived the amenities revolution. So I don't see much in the way of pong tables and the foosball and
stuff
like
that. Oh,
there's
so much more now.
Well, you know,
there's pickleball, you name it.
It's funny. I mean, I think on the one hand that's right. And I think that there are employers that are trying to seduce and incentivize their employees to come back by saying, you can do all of these things. But the truth is that these are still tough times. A lot of companies are trying to recover revenue. They're trying to be more efficient. They're trying to be, you know, more on purpose. And so I think that they may build these things and they may put some of these spaces in. But I believe that when there people show up, nobody is going to want to be the first guy at the foosball. Now, during lunch, maybe that's a different thing. But I think that we're going to see a more serious workforce. I just think that we're not over this thing. I mean, we're still facing the prospect that we could have recessions. We're still facing disconnects with respect to supply chain issues and things like that. But most companies have a lot of work still to do to get back to pre-COVID in many respects. And I think they're going to be more focused on productivity than on entertainment, as an example. Now, having said that, as far as the couches go and things like that, you know, I've run call centers all over the world, and posture turned out to be a very important consideration in a call center. You can tell whether somebody is doing their job on the phone as you walk by, depending on their posture, depending on their facial expressions. And I think that, you know, if we encourage people to come back and we have everything that looks like the frat house lounge as opposed to a work environment, that may not be the correct messaging either. I think that what we're going to try to figure out is a middle ground. And I do think that there'll be more shared working spaces. I certainly think we'll see more little working spaces where two and three people can get together, because I think that that collaboration will have been missing when they're remote. And so the ability to have a bunch of these ad hoc meetings, I think, will be significant. But as far as the furniture goes, I don't know. You know, we'll see whether there are changes in the physicality of these work areas and in the equipment that are really material. I don't know yet. You know, we've experimented over the years with the ability to plug multiple laptops into a display. You know, there used to be, when I was at Amazon, the biggest and the best thing in the whole world was that there wasn't a single conference room in Amazon. that you couldn't go into. And all you would say is, Alexa, start the meeting. And every bit of the technology would be taken care of. That has yet to populate the entire rest of the world, where people still spend the first 20 minutes of a meeting trying to figure out whether they can turn on the display, whether the speakerphone is working, and all these other things. So we've got a way to go.
Yeah, well, you nailed it, because a lot of the companies are investing a lot more in technology because they're building out those smaller conference room and meeting areas. So the technology is becoming more and more important. So you can just be fluid amongst the space.
Yeah, for sure.
You mentioned shared space within someone's office. Let's talk about some shared service providers and where that fits into the landscape right now. There's a lot in the press about WeWork. They're always the one who loves to get beat up by the press, but there's a lot of other providers out there. They've been offering services for many, many years, and there's been winners and losers. WeWork seems to be on the losing end of that. Where do you think the future of shared office space is?
Well, I think WeWork is only on the losing end of that in a relative sense. I mean, I think they have no moat anymore, and I think that they don't have a competitive differentiation. But we only regard that as losing because of their alleged prospects, you know, way back when. On the other hand, they're still in a space that was nicely built out. They're still in good locations. And they still offer, you know, startups. And frankly, they offer sort of mid-level businesses up to $50 or $100 million in revenues who, you know, a friend of mine in the real estate business said that the best lease in the world was a one-year lease with infinite options to extend.
I read that.
Yeah. I'm seeing a variation of that in some of the buildings just around us, Convene and some of these other spaces, where you can, as you grow, you can sort of attach or append expansion space at a very modest cost, and you don't feel like you're overcommitting. But they do have flexibility to let you grow. And that's the best thing for a startup. I mean, the truth is, you don't want to get ahead of yourself. You don't want to have a lot of, as we learned during COVID, I mean, the companies that aren't here anymore, the companies that had substantial unavoidable infrastructure and fixed costs.
Yeah.
The companies that were small or big pretty much survived. I mean, if you were small, you went home.
Yeah.
If you were big, you had the resources to stick around.
Yeah.
So I think that shared spaces are going to, we'll get over COVID. I think they'll come back as a flexibility kind of thing. One of the things I wrote a while ago was, you know, think about law firms, think about banks, how we used to believe that a bank had to have some kind of giant marble monumental building to convince us of their stability, or a law firm had to have floors and floors, and every partner had a conference table in his office and all these amenities to show they were. And frankly, startups, you know, weren't taken seriously if they didn't have bricks and mortar. But in the world we live in today, that's probably a detriment. It's probably not good news to say, yeah, we have a huge physical facility that's half empty because our people aren't here. So I think that the whole perspective of what kind of physical space you have and what kind of commitments you make is changing, and we'll see. We'll see where that ends up.
Yeah. Yeah. Most landlords are not interested in entertaining a one-year deal with multiple extensions.
Exactly.
But in this environment, you can ask for anything.
Yeah.
Then it becomes a question of credit and if it's GE's asking or whoever.
Or NTI. I mean, right? I mean, you know, you're not going to.
The numbers are extraordinary right now in terms of construction. That's why the spec suites, pre-built space are all moving first and foremost.
Yeah.
You mentioned something in terms of, so when at what point in a startup's culture or in a startup stage does it make sense to go from either 100% virtual to shared office to maybe committing to a, you know, a true, you know, call it a 5-year, 10-year lease sort of thing?
You know, I think it's a funny thing because, you know, you could ask a different variation of that question, which is, when does the CEO of a startup not have to go on every sales call? Okay. And what that tells you is that you have an established product. The CEO doesn't have to be at the meeting so that he can promise 12 adjustments and 14 variations and 3 price cuts in order to get something closed. But what it really says is you've built a recurring, stable set of business offerings. And I think at that point, you then decide what is the counterpart from a physical commitment space? You know, do you need a certain presence? You need a certain office and things like that. So I think it depends on the development of the business. Now, having said that, if you're a virtual business and you're always going to be a virtual business, then I think that maybe you never make that final jump, because I think you want to preserve the ability to decide. And this is, you know, we said before, you know, I think that companies are increasingly starting to look at what city do they want their headquarters, if you even have a true headquarters. Where do they want that to be? Where do they want their concentration of employees to be? And the one thing that's very clear is that as part of the hiring equation, part of these conversations now have much more to do with quality of life, the ability to live in areas that are safe and secure, transportation issues, and even weather and things like that, much more so than before. I mean, I think it's almost impossible, for example, to hire somebody to move into San Francisco these days. I think that we're actually seeing people come back from the coasts to Chicago for lifestyle reasons.
Yeah, and there's this concept of, I think, climate migration. There's people that are moving here. I was just looking at the El Nino or the season. It's going to be a little bit warmer this year in Chicago. Yeah. So 50 degrees in January.
Yeah, global warming hasn't hurt Chicago.
Right.
But I think also that it depends on your workforce. If your workforce is one that depends on people working for you for 20 years and growing with your business, that's a completely different business model. You know, today we have companies that if their employees stayed 3 years, they would be grateful. Okay, we have tremendous turnovers in terms of that, and that's a product of the gig economy. It's a product of virtuality with some of these companies. And it's also a product of a group of employees that don't believe in the old model, that you sign up with one company and that's where you spend your life or your career. So all of this has changed. And, you know, I was talking to some people about sending your kid to college. I think that you live in Glencoe. I used to live in Highland Park. The parents in those suburbs went to schools that were at a certain level, certain kind of school by and large. And I don't think it's dawned on them quite yet that their kids are not going to go to those same schools. I think their kids are going to, I mean, forget upward mobility. I think that they don't understand how that world has changed. And so what used to be, it's funny, they've even changed the language. The guidance counselors at high schools now don't talk about safety schools anymore. These are now the new list that you make are called foundation schools. And that's a polite way of saying those are the schools that you believe you could always get into. Now, that used to be the University of Illinois here. It used to be any major state school. These days, you'd be lucky if your kid got into some of those schools. And so, so that's going to change things. I think vocational education is going to change the game significantly. I think we're going to have millions of people that are going to finally bite the bullet and say, my kid doesn't have to go to a four-year school if he wants to be a digital technologist or if he wants to work with, you know, cars or things like that. And honestly, you know, a mechanic at my car place will make $125,000 this year.
Yeah.
And that's a path to a sustainable middle-class income that getting a four-year degree in philosophy probably isn't.
Yeah. Do you believe in an MBA?
I think that the smartest guy that I have talked to in the last 2 years was a guy at the University of Chicago. What they've done is they've appended to the two-year MBA a six-month program in computer science. And that's a good package, okay? I think that—
That's paired,
you do it at the same time.
Oh, okay.
And I think, why? Because I think that there isn't a new company coming in to the world for the next 10 years that technology isn't gonna be a component, part of the equation. Yeah. So, but as far as the MBA goes, I think it's a colossal waste of money.
Okay.
Colossal.
What responsibility do companies have to provide either, you know, educational services or health and wellness opportunities? Health and wellness is a huge thing. And, you know, we're Suicide Prevention Month, I think, and the anxiety is tremendous. I've had Bernie Dime on this podcast before, and he's talked about the numbers being astronomical compared to previous, you know, in the last 5 years, they've gone up, I mean, 100-fold. But what responsibilities do the companies have to provide resources?
Well, I think that they have to provide the financing. I don't think they should have to. They can provide the resources. I don't think you can pick and choose what a group of employees is going to need. So I think what you have to do is provide the benefit, say, we'll pay for this, but you have to leave that completely up to, I mean, if you look at Billions, you know, and Wendy is the resident shrink, I think that there's no such thing in the real world as somebody who is going to be able to deal with the 40 or 50 crazy employees that you have. So I think that we're going to see more and more companies that are going to self-insure these benefits and provide these benefits. My brother has a company that's doing that aggressively now. But I don't think that you can bring it in-house. I think you just have to fund it and let each employee be responsible for the choices that they make. I just don't think that's an employer's responsibility.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of a strife amongst employees and employer right now. They're expecting their employers to not only provide it, but also kind of hold their hand through it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of partially how they were raised.
Yeah. So it is how they were raised. And I think it's an impossible undertaking.
Right.
So
switching gears to kind of looking towards the future of cities like Chicago, challenging times with every major city. What are some things that leaders can do and are doing to make Chicago, for example, prosper in the future?
Well, look, I think that since Mayor Emanuel's time, I think the two drivers of the economy in any major urban city are the business community and the technology communities now. And I think that you have to make efforts to make it very hospitable and very attractive for businesses to come here and to remain here, whether they're, you know, whatever kind of businesses they are. You have to make your central business district vibrant and alive. And, you know, we depend on entertainment, we depend on restaurants, we depend on theater, we depend on sports. Chicago is a great, great place, but we haven't had the kind of leadership that's really brought that front and center in a while. I mean, I remember when Mayor Lightfoot, her first campaign was going to be that, you know, they were looking for a central focal point. And the central focal point, as opposed to food, music, sports, and 12 other things, was diversity. And I was like, I don't know exactly that I'm going to come to Chicago for a weekend because it's a diverse city. I think that's a nice, you know, sort of mathematical determination. And it's nice that we're a diverse city or that we're aspiring to be. But I don't think that that's front and center in terms of what a city needs to hold out if it wants to be viable going forward. Now, you know, at the complete other side, if I were responsible for planning the city of Chicago, I would say that 30 or 40% of the street space in the downtown area of every central business district in the United States is taken over by cars, whether it's parking garages, parking on the street, or parking. I think we're well beyond the point where you could take an 8-square block part of some downtown city and you could say, no cars and trucks are allowed here. We're going to have shuttle vehicles. We're going to bite the bullet to make it a carbon clean electric footprint. And the Loop is a perfect example. And Chicago could be a leader for the world of doing that. And it's the kind of thing that it takes a visionary mayor and a visionary group of business leaders to do. And I'd love to see that happen. I mean, I think that's actually workable. I mean, Rahm was talking about improving the transportation from O'Hare back and forth and things like that. These are things that are really important. I mean, the difference between having a 2-hour business meeting and a 6-hour business meeting because the attendees from out of town are freaking out in both directions on issues of transportation and getting to and from the airports and things like that is a huge difference. I mean, you know,
how do you pay for it?
Well, I think the downtown thing basically pays for itself. I mean, I think that the truth is if you eliminated, well, first of all, you know, these parking garages that we have all over the downtown area are 6-story garages, 8-story garages. That couldn't be a worse use of a square block if you look next to Sears or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. couldn't be a worse and lower use. And the city owns those properties under the maybe the long-term leases that they've cut with parking facilities. But those could be turned into high-rise buildings, and honestly, parking could be put in there. But the real goal is whether we're going to say that we're committed to the automobile. And by the way, this, you know, this downtown model of having shuttles and things like that and parking only at the perimeters, that could be extended to things like what's going on with Lincoln Yards. You know, you've got a complete ability there to say, we're just going to say on day one, we're not going to have huge parking structures here. We're not going to have, you know, a million cars trying to fight over a limited number of bridges and passageways. We're going to have a solution that's next generation solution. Northwestern University could do it on their campus. I mean, we investigated when I was running the facility at IIT, having these kinds of vehicles, and we looked all over the world as to who was doing it well. And it's not that hard. It's not that challenging. But, you know, I think what you discover is that in terms of wear and tear, in terms of time saved, in terms of safety and security and pollution and gasoline, you know, I mean, if you go to New York City now, you know, the estimate to get like 8 blocks across Manhattan is, you know, 40 minutes or something.
Well, everyone walks. Walkers in New York.
Yeah. So, and by the way, I mean, the bike issue is a whole nother set of issues that's very interesting, and the scooters and all of these kinds of things. So look, I think there are ways that cities could make gestures to say, we're looking to the future and here's the kinds of things that we're committing to that are very meaningful. On the other hand, you know, so far in the city here, we're seeing basically just the opposite. You know, they're talking about extending the red line for $30 or $50 million south. And there's four other train lines that presently pass through that exact same area that could be used without rebuilding. You can imagine the difference between rebuilding entire new tracks for, you know, miles and miles and adding a station to an existing rail line is a trivial expense. So, you know, we're not being smart about the things that are going on in the city. And I think that the cities that are going to be the leaders going forward are going to be the ones that demonstrate that they're thinking 25 years ahead.
Have you been to a city in the last few years, either, you know, North America or overseas, that you've been impressed by in terms of what they're doing?
I was in Tokyo, and I can't imagine a better city. It's clean. The trains run 24 hours a day. Nobody thinks twice about crime. Nobody thinks about, I mean, and look, it's a strange, enclosed community with virtually no immigration, and, you know, but if you want to go to a place where the food is great, the transportation is great, it's clean, the people are all courteous and accommodating. I mean, it's, you know, Ram is there now and is the prince of the city and probably thinks he died and went to heaven. And the time that I spent there, it was remarkable. It was truly remarkable. Now, you know, U.S. cities, you know, I don't know. I think that what's happened on both of the coasts is these weather catastrophes have been so offsetting for whatever you might otherwise find appealing about, forgetting the politics, appealing about some of these cities, has led me to look more at places like Nashville, Atlanta, Austin. And by the way, these are all places where I wouldn't be looking at them but for the fact that Chicago businesses have relocated there, or people that used to work for us have now picked up during COVID and moved there and said, we're happy to continue working for your Chicago-based business, if that's even such a thing. Now, I don't know if your leadership is in Miami and your resources are in Texas and your servers are in Australia. I don't know how you get to call yourself a Chicago-based business anymore, but that's the world we live in, and it's going to continue to be distributed in really substantial ways.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time. This has been very insightful.
My watch is telling me it's time to stand up. So I think that I think we must be at the end of our adventure.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Howard.